speaker is Dr. Thomas Tom Ducey, who is a microbiologist. He came in this morning and said he is not a wetland scientist, but that's the idea of the session, is to mix it. So he describes himself as a jack of all trades who gets pulled into a lot of wetland projects. And Dr. Ducey works at the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Florence, South Carolina. He's involved with a wide variety of research projects ranging from biochar research to row crop studies. The areas and wetlands that he's gotten involved in includes investigations of the effectiveness of wetland conservation practices and denitrification in restored wetlands. He'll be talking today about mid-Atlantic wetland conservation effects, assessment, simultaneous physiochemical and biological assessment of wetland functions. So thank you, Tom, for helping to organize the session and presenting.
Thank you, Jacob, for the introduction. I'd like to thank Brian as well for allowing Soil Biology and Biochemistry Division to co-host with you guys, and thank you for your attention. So that title is quite a handful. I don't even remember coming up with that one, but usually I try to keep them a little pithy, but obviously not on this time. I'm going to do acknowledgments in front because I'm just a small spoke in this large wheel of this Mid-Atlantic Wetlands Conservation Project. So my co-authors, we've done several papers together, and so I co-authored them on this talk as well. But us and then several other institutions, particularly University of Maryland, Martin Ravenhorst's group, Agricultural Research Service, Clinton Church and his group, Mark Walbridge, who was critical in getting a lot of this funding and this project running. And then Judy Denver with the U.S. Geological Survey, Dennis Wingman with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, and then Joseph Mitchell, who are all involved in this final NRCS report, which is now online. You can see it. I've got the link down here. You can download it and read it. It basically coalesces all of the manuscripts that we've published to date on this project. I want to give a particular shout-out to Megan Lang. She is now the Chief Scientist in National Wetland Inventory for the U.S. Wildlife, Fish and Wildlife Service, and she is basically the brainchild behind, and she's the curator of all this work, and this report is her child. So if you really have any questions about it, go bother her. She would be happy to talk to you about it. So a little bit of the background. The Mid-Atlantic Regional SEEP Wetland Study is one of five regional studies of the wetland component of the SEEP project, which is a much larger project itself, so we're just a small subset. And our goal was to quantify environmental benefits of conservation practices to essentially see when we restore wetlands, are we actually having a positive environmental impact. As I mentioned and as you saw, it was a multi-institutional undertaking. And our project, our portion, was essentially to measure the greenhouse gases, particularly nitrous oxide. And so we've done a large portion of the data collection, on-site sampling, and now the project's sort of moving into this modeling phase with some supporting sampling here and there when required. So here is the Mid-Atlantic region that we worked with. It covers the Delmarva region, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, and then a few sites in North Carolina. So everywhere from the Eastern Shore down to the Pocosin region. And I'll talk a little bit. We did wind up splitting the analyses up because there is some significant soil differences between the Delmarva region and the soils in North Carolina, and it does play out in the responses that we saw to wetland restoration. So when we were looking at wetland restoration, you want to compare it to what has been in the past and then what it came from. And so we actually had three land management types in the study. And so the first obviously is natural wetlands. And so we know that these haven't been farmed for at least the past 100 years or so since there's been records of the sites. The restored sites were once wetlands. They were deforested and drained and turned into croplands, and then now the landowners are turning them back into wetlands, so they're hydrologically restoring them through a number of methods that are recommended by NRCS. And then we have the prior converted croplands. So these were wetlands, they were deforested, drained, and they continue to remain farmlands to this date. And so those NAT, RST, and PCC, you'll see those symbols throughout the talk. So since a lot of these, actually since most of the, we're dealing with private owners, I'm not going to show you exactly where they are because, well, first off, when you knock on their door and say, hi, I'm from the government, getting them to cooperate right off the bat is kind of difficult. And so this was a very hard undertaking. A lot of effort goes to Megan Lang and Jared Miller for working with the farmers and the landowners and getting them to give us access and continued access over a period of years. And so what we tried to do is when we would find, we had our natural wetlands, trying to find restored sites and croplands all within roughly a 1 to 4 kilometer area. And so that was kind of difficult. We actually managed to do it though, and with the cooperation of the farmers. And so these couple maps, I'm not going to tell you where they are, but just illustrate how we tried to get everything within close proximity to kind of cut down on the amount of spatial variability that we would have in the results. So once we were able to acquire our sites, we looked at them on GIS, verified, and then randomly selected areas of differing elevation, and then we went into the field and actually verified that what we saw in GIS was actually true on the ground. And so we split them up into, and depending on the paper that you read, it's either, and it depends on how the reviewers accepted the term, a relative wetness or relative elevation. And so we tried to come up with a transect where we had a low elevation, which was obviously your wetter soils, up to a higher elevation, which was your driest. So, and then sampled from those over a period of a few years. And we tried to do at least a couple samplings in the spring and the early summer, and then we return and do a couple in the fall and the winter, trying to work around the crop cycles as well with the farmers. And so here's just one of the maps that kind of shows what one of our landscape maps in the prior converted croplands looked like. So the physical chemical assessments, we did a number of studies looking at biological aspects, but we did a lot of physical chemical work as well. And so I like this map. It just basically shows how things sorted out in the initial analyses. And so you can see right off the bat we have, since the agricultural lands are heavily managed, both the sites from the Delmarva and the North Carolina sites do coalesce, cluster close together. But then we look at the more mineral soils of the Delmarva region, and so the restored and the natural sites do group together far away from the North Carolina cluster, where the restored and natural sites sort out together as well. And so that kind of laid the framework of, so when I'm going to show you the data, I'm going to show you both data from Delmarva and then from North Carolina, and so there are differences between the two. So the first one here essentially is carbon storage. The top is from Daniel Fenstermacher's thesis defense. And so in Delmarva, we could see right off the bat that the natural sites have a lot more carbon. The lower portion is the total carbon that we measured in our studies, and they follow a similar pattern, that we get a large amount of carbon storage in the natural sites, and that the restored and the prior croplands have a low amount of carbon. So the restored sites really haven't reverted back to form. North Carolina, we do actually see a little bit of a twist on this. The restored sites actually have a much higher carbon storage going on. And so, and I didn't mention this, but at the time of these studies, the wetlands were restored roughly about 6 to 8 years. And so the study went over a couple of years. So now basically all these sites are over a decade or so into restoration processes at this point. But we're looking at roughly this snapshot of a 6 to 8 years post-restoration. Soil physical characteristics, carbon-nitrogen ratio, moisture, EC and pH. I just cherry-picked those out of our manuscripts, but I just wanted to highlight a couple things. First is that we see some instances where the restoration sites look exactly like the prior cropland, so there's no movement in change of these characteristics. And then in some instances like pH, for example, in North Carolina, the restored sites look very similar to their natural wetland counterparts. And then in some instances, like in North Carolina, we see the restored sites actually exceed what we would see in the naturally restored sites. But then we have these other ones where we have the restored sites are kind of stuck in the middle, and so we're calling that the agricultural legacy, that the effects of extensive cropping over time, now moving them into a hydrological restoration. And so we're seeing movement, potentially, because these are snapshots, back to a natural status. But how long they're in this phase or not is something that we're not entirely sure of. We do have some plans to go back and look at new wetlands versus older restored wetlands to see if we see a continued shift back towards a natural status, or if they're kind of stuck in this paradigm for a while. Soil characteristics, I once again just cherry-picked a couple of different elements to look at. And once again, we can see that in some instances, we really don't have much of a difference between the restored sites and the prior croplands that they once were. And then in some instances, for example, here with potassium in Delmarva, we do see that they've returned to a natural wetland type values. And then once again, with some of them, we have this legacy. Now, I'm only reporting, as I mentioned earlier, that we looked at a relative elevation. These are all from the lowest elevation. The report has all of the numbers, but I mean, this is already laden with data. I wasn't going to bog it down fourfold more. One thing that did change, though, and we saw pretty rapidly, was phosphorus. The restored sites returned to natural levels pretty rapidly. A similar result is for nitrate, but I don't show it. But statistically, they were pretty similar to what we see with the phosphorus. How the phosphorus was reduced is open to debate. Chances are it was probably flushed out of the system. We had mobilization out of the wetlands. But with the restored sites, some of them were actually excavated as a part of the restoration process. So they may have actually, that phosphorus may have been pulled off site and deposited elsewhere. But we do see overall that the phosphorus levels and nitrate levels are reduced in both Delmarva and North Carolina. So on to the biological assessments. Now, some of this data is not mine. We had nothing to do with it. Mitchell, this is his report. But to give you an overview of and it's in the NRCS report, so just kind of give you a bit more of a view of what's going on biologically. And he was able to demonstrate that with the restored sites, we do see an increase in total species richness in both Delmarva and North Carolina compared to the prior cropland. So we do have amphibians moving back into the system. And in some cases, like in North Carolina, we have actually higher species richness in the restored sites as compared to the natural. Plants. So this is once again a busy slide, but in the this A panel here is the natural wetlands. Across from it's the restored sites, and then below is the prior converted croplands. And so, highlighting, and can you see that highlight? It actually is showing up kind of poorly, but those areas that are highlighted are the woody species. And so the natural, they're almost all entirely forested. And so in the restored sites, we only have a couple of sweet gum and red maple in the restored sites. And those were actually actively planted by the land owners. So they were not naturally introduced. It was artificial. And so this graph just basically kind of sums that up, that in the natural sites, we have a very large predominance of woody species. And that drops between the other two land management types. But restored sites do have a higher level of woody species than the converted croplands. So this was in Mathia Yepsen's study, that prior slide and this slide. And so going over a little bit more, we can see that native species increase in both in the restored sites as compared to the croplands. We look at the richness. Restored sites actually have a high degree of species richness. And then the Shannon evenness index is similar between both the natural and the restored sites over the croplands now. These next two indicators, the anthropogenic activity index is the amount of human intervention into the sites. And then the inverse is the coefficient of conservation. So looking at the ability of those plants to resist human interference. And so we can see that as we move the croplands, obviously, are very highly managed, so we have a high AAI, and then the inverse, when we look at the correlation, the coefficient of conservation, we have the natural wetlands are very well conserved, and the restored sites are moving in that direction, it appears. So now into my area, the microbes. We did a 16S sequencing early on in the study. We looked at the first three variable regions. We did Roche 454 sequencing, a little bit other details there, DNA extraction, we used the mobile kits. And we looked at the lowest elevation at this point. So we looked at the wettest samples. And we did a spring and a fall sampling. On the side here, the top here is the soil properties, and we can see once again that the soil in North Carolina moves over to one corner of the graph, and so we had a much larger difference in those soils compared to the Delmarva, and that actually plays out then down with the bacterial OTUs at the bottom. So we did see that that spatially geography did play a role in the selection of microbial communities. I'm not going to show you any of the heat maps or anything of that nature, but I think this Venn diagram actually does a pretty good job of coalescing that data. So really, there's only about 20% of the microbial communities are actually found in all of the land management. So they're the base population. And so roughly 62% of the remaining 13,000 or some odd OTUs that we identified were actually management specific. And I thought this was kind of interesting because these restored sites are essentially only about 6 to 8 years old at this point, and they've already established their own unique microbial community. And so we actually see that play out a little bit in the nitrogen cycling that I'm going to show coming up next. But I just thought that was a pretty interesting take home, that the microbial communities have adapted to this restored environment, and so they are their own unique niche. And so are they going to move towards a more natural wetland kind of profile as these sites mature or not is something that we're just going to have to wait and see. And maybe they'll actually, even the landowners will let us go back in 10 years or so and sample again. So we looked at NAS-Z gene abundance. NAS-Z doesn't necessarily correlate with different elements of denitrification, but it does correlate pretty well with the amount of nitrous oxide compared to the overall nitrogen and nitrous oxide that goes through the system. And so we looked at both Delmarva and North Carolina, and we saw something pretty interesting. In the Delmarva region, and this is on a log scale, the natural wetlands had the lowest abundance of NAS-Z in the system. In the North Carolina, though, actually, we saw this suppression of NAS-Z in the restored sites, and that actually, we didn't expect that. And actually, when we saw that, because these results came out ahead of the DEA numbers, and we began to worry, because if there's no NAS-Z and we don't get that reduction of nitrous oxide to dinitrogen gas, we could have a burst of greenhouse gas emissions from these restored sites. So just keep that in mind as I show you the DEA data. So here is the first set of DEA data from the Delmarva region. And so this is just complete DEA. So we stop it, we acetylene block, and we're just looking at the carbon and the nitrogen that's already in the system and see it pushed off all as nitrous oxide. And so actually the restored and natural sites have lower emission rates than the converted sites, and that's actually not too bad. So the converted soils are obviously using the nitrate that's supplied as fertilizer and giving us higher emission rates. And if we break that down, we did four different treatments for denitrification. Incomplete DEA is simply just bottling up the soils and measuring nitrous oxide that comes off. The complete, actually we add acetylene, so we block the NAS-Z step, and so everything that would go off to nitrogen gas is contained as nitrous oxide, and so we can measure that. It's a lot easier to measure nitrous oxide than it is dinitrogen gas. Now the potential incomplete is we add, since most of these soils are nitrate limited, we add nitrate to the system and then allow and look at a maximal rate, if you will, of denitrification going on in the system. And then the potential complete is simply just adding nitrate and acetylene to block it and get a maximal production. So if the system was totally amped up, this is what we would see. So the first thing is that we look at incomplete DEA and we go to potential, and we do see, yes, the soils are nitrate limited. That's not a surprise because most soils are. But then if we look at this potential incomplete to the potential complete, and we look at the difference between those, we actually see that 54% of the nitrogen that we're losing in the system is from nitrous oxide in Delmarva. If we go to North Carolina, remember I mentioned that we saw the suppression of NOS-Z genes in the soils. Well, it actually turns out that instead of getting a large amount of nitrous oxide produced by the restored sites, we actually see a lower, significantly lower amount in those soils. So it looks like the whole nitrogen cycle is being suppressed for some reason in these soils, and we don't know why. So if we look at the DEA in the North Carolina soils, once again, if we look at the incomplete to the potential incomplete, once again, yes, the soils are nitrate limited. But now if we actually look at the difference between the potential incomplete and the complete, actually now we've gone from 54% in the Delmarva losing nitrogen as nitrous oxide down to 43%. So we're actually seeing lower amounts of nitrous oxide being emitted by these restored wetlands in North Carolina. And we really think that this is because of the higher C-to-N ratios. North Carolina, the Pocosin region, they're very organic soils, and so it's probably playing a role in reducing nitrous oxide emissions from these soils. So future directions, where are we going now? Greg McCarty's group in ARS, he has a postdoc, Sha Lee, and she is doing a lot of spatial studies and modeling. And so a paper that she has actually got out for review right now is looking at the denitrification potential and of these soils, and looking to see if we can model and explain what values and what properties of these wetlands are actually leading to denitrification. And so this is some of the data from her first paper. And so denitrification potential is essentially that complete DEA that I showed, that we're blocking with acetylene with nitrate, so maximal potential. And the capacity is just that what's already inherent in the soils. And so she's been able to show that actually relief, topographical relief, or what we would call that relative elevation, is a great predictor of denitrification potential, so what the soils are actually capable of if they were completely nitrate loaded. And then looking at this capacity, it actually correlates pretty well with EC values. So that's just some of the work that we're doing right now. So I don't have a conclusion slide because I had a lot of slides and I thought there wasn't going to be time, but obviously there is. But so just basically to hammer home a couple of points is that so it looks like in a number of instances from physical, chemical, and biological properties, we are getting these restored sites to look more like their natural counterparts. But there does remain this agricultural legacy, if you will. How long that's going to take for that to kind of wash or work its way out, who knows. We may have this new paradigm of restored wetlands. We may have created new wetlands that they always have these kind of characteristics. It's hard to know. But with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them if I can. Right, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you make that into consideration?
We did not. They were both in there, but we just kind of grouped them all together as a restored. And so it may have added some variability to the study, but they're both types were done, but we just kind of grouped them all together.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely.
There
is, it's there, and we have it, but off the top of my head, I can't get you those numbers, but
Megan has them, and they're probably even in that NRCS report. So all that stuff's been done, and she knows what sites, how they were managed to restoration. So the answers can be found. Yeah. Yes.
So the third one, I think I understand, is the total DEA that you've got, which normally DEA you load with nitrate.
Yes.
How did you get to the fourth one? Nitrate first, wait a while?
Yeah, so the first one is that complete, and that's just what's everything that's in the system, the carbon and nitrogen that's in the system. That second bar was that plus acetylene, so we blocked that nitrous oxide reduction step. The third one was adding nitrate to the system to see whether the soils were nitrate limited or not.
So
and then that.
The system you at the moment you did the DEA assay and not before.
No, they're all mixed together and then we run them. And then that fourth one is the nitrate plus acetylene. So we're kind of trying to maximize what would it drive everything to nitrous oxide. All right. Thank you for your time.